Caitlin, have you ever dated someone your parents really disapproved of? Like you had to climb out your bedroom window and jump off the roof to sneak off with him kind of thing.
I can't say I ever jumped out a bedroom window, but I definitely told my parents I was somewhere when I was actually somewhere else. He was an atheist.
Right. The atheist high school boyfriend we have discussed before.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. My parents were pretty nice about everyone I dated, but I definitely think they were just being polite about a couple of them.
I mean, I kind of wish my parents had maybe said something a couple times.
Oh, you would have hated him for it. You wouldn't have listened.
No, I wouldn't have. But, I mean, the guy with the bleached tips and all the emotional volatility, it would have saved me some future embarrassment. From Religion News Service, this is Saved by the City, a podcast from two Christian women swiping left and right through the mean streets of New York. I'm Caitlin Beatty.
And I'm Roxy Stone.
I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. This week on The State of Belief, Jim Wallis, founder of Sojourners and author of the new book, The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy.
It's a culmination, summation of the work that a lot of us have done for an awful long time. I think the time has come for a serious test of faith.
The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app. I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. The State of Belief is a weekly podcast with a potent mix of spiritual wisdom, political strategy, and hopeful commentary. In a series of inspiring conversations, celebrating our diversity, and bringing us together to, in the words of the great James Baldwin, achieve our country. The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app.
All right, so what do you think your parents would look for in your ideal spouse or partner? Like if they could pick someone, what qualities would they be on the hunt for?
That's a good question. I feel like they've tried very hard not to tell me what they would look for, but
what is it about,
you know,
that
they're trying to keep boundaries. I think obviously they would want me to have a partner who is loving and caring, who is stable, you know, who has like a good head on his shoulders, has a decent job, or just a job. They'd probably prefer that I end up with somebody who's a Christian. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be a bonus if, like, he also enjoyed birdwatching or the outdoors. Like, because then we could all do things together.
Definitely.
You're getting married in a few months. So does this mean that John is the embodiment of all the qualities your parents would have picked for you?
Well.
And he's listening, just,
yes.
Just so you know.
Many of them, I think. He is very good to me. He loves me. He's caring. He makes me laugh. He respects me. That's something that maybe all parents, but I could definitely say that my parents wanted. Like, they wanted somebody who treated me well. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom notices little things. Like, she'll be like, oh, I just love the way he looks at you. Or, like, I can just tell how much he cares for you. And so I think, like, those are the things she's noticing, you know. I'm sure that if asked, my parents would have been like, a millionaire, please. Not necessarily a priest.
For the security thing.
Exactly. Like, just to know I'm taken care of. And also, like, it's nice to not have to worry about money. And probably they would have really preferred that maybe this person really wanted to live in Colorado someday.
So, does John want to live in Colorado someday?
It hasn't come up as one of his bucket lists.
John, pray about it. Roxy's mom told us to drop this in here so you could be prompted.
Do you think you'd like the person your parents picked for you? Would you trust them to? Like, if you were like, okay, mom and dad, I give up. Just pick someone. Send them my way.
If I really, really wanted to get married and I was at my wit's end, and this were the arrangement that my parents were like, we're recommending Bill. Please not Bill. Bob. These are all men, like, in their age demographic. Given, like, in some ways, I would say yes. Like, given that I am such a product of who they are and our families culture. We are aligned in a lot of ways. Like, I don't think they would pick somebody who's so fundamentally off for me. Mm-hmm. I do think there would be qualities that I am looking for that they probably wouldn't value as much as I do, yeah. or maybe don't get about mm-hmm. me. mm-hmm. Ways that were just different. I think they might miss some of those qualities.
Okay, what is one you're thinking of?
It has always been valuable to me to be able to go deep in conversation with somebody. Mm-hmm. That's true for friends as well as for a romantic partner. That is probably more centrally important to me than some other things.
Same. I think that's something that my parents would have missed too. The deeper, but also like kind of wanting that like intellectual and spiritual curiosity and being able to have those conversations with somebody. Sort of like our episode last week with Krista Tippett.
Okay, so we want to marry that. Krista Tippett. Well, if we can't find the male equivalent of Krista Tippett, which we're going to be looking for a while.
Yeah.
And I understand, like, it's probably not going to be like that all the time, right?
Right.
Like, your married life together isn't going to be sitting around talking about poetry or
right, with some whiskey and a cigar on a porch.
But if you never went there,
right,
I think I would feel like this is a core thing that is missing mm-hmm. for me, that is part of how I connect with other people.
I feel like parents being a part of the dating or courting or marrying process is like such a quaint old idea. Mm-hmm. And it's funny how we just don't do that anymore at all. You don't have to go very far back in Western history to find like parents choosing their kids' matches. I mean, I think of like Pride and Prejudice or Jane Austen. I mean, they weren't necessarily picking matches, but it was like a big deal that you made a good match for the family.
Yeah. I mean, because of inheritance, because of mm-hmm. women's economic dependence on yes. men. Also because people didn't move away.
Right.
A wedding constituted two families joining. Mm-hmm. And probably being in the same worlds or orbits rather than like two individuals from different backgrounds choosing for themselves mm-hmm. what would be best for just them. I mean, I know even in like the individualistic era that we're in, people, of course, still consider, I want my parents to like my spouse yeah. or like we're going to be spending time with them. So I want there to be good connections, but it's not a family affair in the way that it has been.
Yeah. And I think a lot of parents would be like your parents or my parents were of like, that's not really my business. And I need to like good boundaries. Like, I don't want to mm-hmm. force something or like be too opinionated about this area of my child's life.
Yeah. When I think about my parents recommending a man, again, like Bill or Bob, mm-hmm. my emotional reaction is like, Mom, like a teenager who's like, don't tell me what to do, which feels indicative of like how much we individuate from yes. our families.
Yes.
Or we think of becoming an adult as like, I am now different from my family mm-hmm. and do my own thing or mind my own business. And parents, most parents like kind of accept that as well, even though they have opinions.
Well, and I think we've been fed this like narrative that like an arranged marriage or a familial matched marriage is like, there's something to be resisted in that, that that's not ideal. Mm-hmm. Like finding your own true love, like that's the real journey. Like mm-hmm. Romeo and Juliet is like the earliest mm-hmm. idea of that I can think of, where it's like, we're going to resist our family's expectations here and you can't help but fall in love with your soulmate.
Despite all external social and political barriers, like true love wins, except then it didn't for them.
No. Famously star-crossed lovers.
It did work out for Elizabeth Bennet.
Yes.
Because that was a family-approved marriage that was also a love marriage.
The best of both worlds.
Certainly for that time, it would be the ideal.
Recently at RNS, our Hindu reporter, Richa Karmarkar, did a really interesting piece on the rise of Indian matchmaking in the U.S., or kind of rather how second and third generation Indian Americans are reviving. They're turning back to this tradition of Indian matchmaking with an American twist.
Our interview with Richa is coming up later in the show.
But first, Caitlin, we're going to create a biodata sheet for you.
Biodata. Okay, tell me more.
It sounds very sci-fi Galactica vibes. I know.
Yeah.
But Richard writes about how in modern Indian matchmaking, these young singles put together what they call their biodata, which is really just a dating profile. It's sort of an Indian eHarmony set of questions. So I looked some of them up online. They're very fascinating to read. One of the more interesting things to me is how much family information is in each of them.
Which makes sense. Richa mentioned in her piece and in our conversation that Indian matchmaking has a really strong focus on family.
Yes. Most of them also have spots for your zodiac sign and horoscope based on the time and place of your birth, which are both significant in Indian culture. It is a series of questions, which I have slightly adapted for our purposes. So it's a bit more culturally appropriate for you.
We're doing this on me, but not on you.
You know, I'm getting married. The time has passed.
Romantic love, check. Mission accomplished.
Maybe I should do my biodata and have John do his, and then we can send them to a matchmaker and see if they match us.
Yeah.
The true test.
Yeah.
All right. Are you ready?
I think so.
All right. Get ready to meet your match. Okay, it starts out a little like a DMV sheet. Name, date of birth, zip code, etc.
I'm not giving you my social security number.
All right, I'll skip those. Well, let's just do Enneagram since, you know, we're going to match you with a modern day Christian, which means that they'll definitely have done their Enneagram.
Yeah, I am an Enneagram 3 with a 4 wing. The 3 is called the Achiever. So I'm just going to assume our listeners know what that means. 3 with a 4 wing.
Great. Hobbies.
Why do I feel embarrassed?
I don't know.
Do I have hobbies?
Bird watching, karaoke.
I mean, I don't know if reading is a hobby. Reading is very important to me. Yeah. I love movies. I love going to see movies and watching movies at home. Mm-hmm. Church stuff. Walking around New York. Mm-hmm. Love to go on a long walk.
What about a sunset stroll on the beach?
You know, the beach doesn't do that much for me.
Good to know. This is all good biodata. What's your profession?
I am an editor and a writer.
And a podcaster. What are your parents' professions? This is on all the biodata.
My dad worked for a construction company, and my mom was a children's librarian for several years and then ran an educational program at the local YMCA for young children.
Siblings?
I have one younger brother.
Interestingly, they often ask if the sibling is married.
The sibling is married. Mm-hmm. Tyler is married to Sarah, and they have one boy with another boy on the way. I can't remember if I told you that.
You told me about a baby on the way, but I think this is the first time I've heard that it's a boy.
Yes.
Congrats. 3 values you're looking for in a partner.
Okay, when you say values, what do you mean? Qualities? Or does this mean like what you believe?
I think maybe qualities, if I'm reading like what people are writing in these.
Mm-hmm. Intellectual curiosity, the ability to go deep and also very silly.
Mm-hmm. Good.
I can't do someone who's like morose and always stuck in their head. Yeah. And like levity is very important. And some kind of faith practice or interest, ideally of the Christian faith. I mean, yeah, I think those would be the 3 qualities. Hairy.
Oh, right. Of course.
Okay, that's first, actually.
Great. I mean, that helps.
This is my truth.
That's going to help your matchmaker quite a bit.
I'm just imagining my matchmaker is a woman who's like lining up a bunch of men and asking them to take off their shirts.
Yes, definitely.
To see like the quantity and velocity of chest hair.
There's like a speed to test how quick it grows.
Yeah, I need very fast growing hair on my partner.
Okay, we're making some real progress here. Last one, a lot of the biodata has a paragraph about the person, and it seems like a lot of the time it's focused on how the person was raised and how those values have shaped them as an adult. So what would you say are your family's values that were instilled in you as a child, and how do they continue to affect you today?
My parents are people who are very steady and stable and like commit to things for the long haul. Like your word is your bond. You do what you say you're going to do. They definitely pass that along to me. That's something I really value about them and about other people. My parents are modest people. They are not showy or pretentious. Salt of the earth.
Yeah.
This might sound circular. I feel like they instilled in me the importance of family as family. Like you try to maintain a relationship with your family members long term. Like you make a point of seeing them and spending time with them and checking in on them and like keeping those bonds and lines of communication is important.
Love it.
Did I get through the bio data?
You did.
Hypothetically, this bio data would be sent to a matchmaker to use it to help me and my family find a match. Is that how it works?
Yeah. According to Rich's reporting, families really do play a big role in this. Even if they might not have like final say necessarily, they're part of the matchmaking process, at least traditionally in India. I think in the US, in some of her reporting, it seems like what they're reviving is a more formal structure to matchmaking that isn't just like swiping left, swiping right on these apps that serve you up so many people. And it's really, you know, there's nothing kind of behind why you're matched with someone besides your own preference.
Right.
So like one of the things she writes about is this big convention where all these people submit their bio data and they have to be approved, I think, to come to the convention. And then if you are approved, you get to go. And like, I think your bio data is kind of circulated, and there's different events that are as minglers. There's speed dating stuff. There's mixers. There's all kinds of ways that you would meet all the people at this conference who have theoretically in some way been sorted. You might all be potential matches, which, you know, when I was single and really sick of the apps, I wouldn't have minded just being like, put in a room with a couple hundred other people who I know are also single and looking.
And who had been vetted along some
in some
lines.
Way. Right.
Yeah, I think the reason this model feels appealing right now is that a lot of single people recognize the apps are just not cutting it. They are actively bad. And I know they work for some people, right? But
of course,
there's something about how atomized it is and lacking context. Even the risk of like meeting up with a literal stranger. And like kind of how bizarre that is. Then you like never see them again. There's something that feels so random and anonymous about it that at least having some kind of family or communal input, we're all sorting this out like together. It's not just like left up to me or to some algorithm designed in Silicon Valley.
Right.
Humans feel like better gauges of who would make a good partner, if that's what you're looking for, than the algorithms.
I mean, one of the things I felt, especially the last summer when I was dating, and I dated a couple of guys for a little bit of a longer period, for several weeks, right? Which is like a long time when you're talking apps. These relationships never went to like, you're my boyfriend, you're my girlfriend, you know. But I remember them feeling so distinctly separate from my life. My friends never met these people. I scheduled dates with them around the rest of my social calendar. I never saw their friends. I never saw their way of life. It was just like we would meet up somewhere and have a drink and go to dinner or see a movie or take a walk or whatever. And it just felt like our lives had no reason to cross. And I really felt that as a lack. Like, I want my partner and dating to feel somehow integrated into my friend structure, at least. Like, that's my chosen family here in New York. And and to not feel like it's anonymous or separate.
So if a lot of single people in the West agree that the apps aren't working, but are also probably not going to hire a matchmaker because there are professional matchmakers. They mm-hmm. cost a lot of money mm-hmm. and they usually target their services toward a very particular, like, professional high power clientele. Like, what is the better model of meeting a romantic partner?
I mean, I kind of do like this convention sort of thing. I mean, obviously it's like, okay, so who's vetting it and what are you vetting on? Like, there's plenty of these apps or different things that are like, you have to make so much money. You have to be in this particular stratosphere. You have to be a celebrity in some way, like Raya, right? Yes, exactly.
I got admitted, but of course, to be honest, you did. I will be so judgmental if I go on there.
I know. That would be the problem.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I don't want to date an influencer.
Or somebody who thinks that they are that.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
Like, thinks enough of themselves to be like, I deserve a Raya partner.
Exactly. Exactly.
I went to LA a few years ago and I was hanging out with some friends there and they were part of like, I believe what they might have called a post-evangelical church. Mm-hmm. But they had started these once a month single mixers. Mm. And it was basically like you could come, but you could only come if you brought a friend. I can't remember the rules exactly, but it was like, I think everybody had to bring a friend of maybe an opposite attraction because it wasn't an exclusively heterosexual thing, but it was like you had to bring somebody who was not going to be attracted to you or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but it was like,
good luck.
Yeah, right. I know. Because they wanted a mix of people who would,
yes. Not,
they didn't want just a room full of single straight women.
Yes.
Which I feel like is the way a lot of these things are, like matchmaking services. It's like a lot of single straight women who are looking for matches, and it doesn't work if those are the only people who are on there.
Yes.
And they designed like different activities to do with these things. And I was there like not long before Valentine's Day. So they were talking about one that they were doing for Valentine's Day. I don't know that I liked that. I would like to see more mm-hmm. people do that, you know, and I would love to see more churches do that, honestly, like more single mixers by churches.
Okay. But I know that we have complained, if not on the podcast, then in our heart of hearts mm-hmm. about like the awkwardness of church single mixers. And it feels like a meat market.
That's probably true.
And it's always like the really well-meaning awkward man who wants to talk.
I know.
But yes, in theory, our built-in communities, our built-in social context should mm-hmm. have opportunities for people to meet new people. That doesn't feel cringy. That feels like a good thing.
I mean, I do just feel like there were more things like this in the past, you know, like even just thinking about like church dances, like there used to be like in the basement, you know,
yes.
like things like that, where actually like the church was like invested in people meeting each other and maybe they would do it with like other churches or whatever. So it wasn't just like the people you already know that go to your church.
Yes. Have you seen the movie Brooklyn?
That's what I was thinking of, only I read the book.
Oh, yes.
Well, no, that is truly actually the thing I had in mind was that dance where they met.
Yes. And the church this designated, I don't know, social event mm-hmm, mm-hmm. where like the explicit purpose was for single people, single men and women to come and meet one another and get an opportunity to dance together. And you hope like maybe mm-hmm. a man will ask me out on a date from this. And I think even if we don't know exactly what that could look like today, there is something to that.
Do you think it's another instance sort of like we were talking about with our parents where the church is like, oh, that's not any of our business. We don't want to get involved in our parishioners' dating lives, you know?
Yeah, because I would have to think enough pastors realize that these kinds of events can feel cringy. Mm-hmm. Although I have a friend who attended, well, she lived in Dallas and there was a large, like influential, non-denominational mega church that had a weekly young adults gathering where there were hundreds of like young, attractive evangelical Christians living in Dallas who would go. Mm-hmm. And it was a whole thing. I probably wouldn't like that vibe either, but I guess it depends where you live. Maybe these things are more common than we realize.
Yeah. Actually, that might
and
be true.
And we're just not in those spaces.
Are we aged out? Maybe they're like really geared toward 20-somethings a lot of times at churches.
I would have to think that's true just because that's when a lot of them get married. Like mm-hmm. they're just getting married at a younger age mm-hmm. than Americans across the board.
So we're not going to solve this right now. Okay, let's hear more from Richa about how young Indian Americans of many religious backgrounds are reviving the cultural practice of matchmaking.
And so it's like, okay, these agencies have caught on to like, okay, how do we mix this? Like, how do we get these kids who are looking for, you know, real, true love, but mix it with something that has worked within our families, you know, for years.
But first, a shout out for our sponsors who make this all possible.
Religion News Service is an independent, award-winning source of global reporting on religion, spirituality, culture, and ethics.
From Holy Week to Holi, Religion News Service is the go-to destination for timely conversations on religions new and old.
Our listeners should know that Saved by the City has some podcast company. Religion News Service now has a podcast network. It includes Martini Judaism with Rabbi Jeffrey Salkin and The State of Belief with Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. Give them a listen.
We'd also love to hear your feedback and ideas for future guests and topics. Drop us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts or shoot us an email at sbtcpodcast@religionnews.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Hey there, curious minds.
Get ready to embark on a unique journey at the crossroads of money and religion with our new podcast, Money Meet Meaning.
The seductive effect of money, we think it can do the work that God does because there's something about money that does that. It's wild.
I'm Amber Hacker.
And I'm Tom Levinson.
Tune in for a blend of wisdom and levity as we decode the path to a more meaningful relationship with money.
I think giving, and this is a little crass, but I feel like it's the ultimate middle finger to money. It's liberating to give some away.
This podcast is your gateway to a vibrant and thought-provoking exploration of the interconnectedness of wealth and spirituality.
Join us as we unravel the surprising influence of ancient wisdom on modern finances.
Faith pervades people's lives and our society. And because money is such an important part of people's lives, exploring that intersection of faith and money, I think is super, super interesting.
Get ready to be informed, entertained, and inspired to transform your financial outlook with Money Meet Meaning. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
So we have a fun guest today, one of my newsroom colleagues. Richa Karmarkar is our Hindu reporter and recently did a fun piece on matchmaking and how it's becoming popular again in the U.S. among the Indian diaspora. Welcome to the show, Richa.
Thank you. I'm really excited about it.
Thanks so much for being here.
All right. So tell us a little bit about this piece and this article and why you decided to report it. Like, what gave you the idea that this practice was becoming popular in the U.S.?
It started because of my own Instagram feed, honestly. Okay. I started seeing, you know, these matchmaking conventions and, you know, ads for matchmaking services. And I always knew, you know, as I talk about in the piece, I always knew like Indian matchmaking has been kind of like this phenomenon that people are talking about anyways. But specifically in the diaspora here, you know, I didn't realize that it was making a comeback, as I say. Mm. And yeah, it really started in my own media.
So you were being targeted.
I was definitely being targeted. I definitely think I was. And it worked for this, at least. Mm-hmm. I just recently got back from a trip to India for a month. And it was already on my mind. Marriage was already on my mind. You know, love, matchmaking, things like that. And when I came back, you know, I wrote this matchmaking story.
We'll come back to the reason why love and marriage was on your mind on this trip. But I feel sheepish asking you such a personal question since we literally just met, but maybe talk a little bit about how matchmaking has historically worked in Indian marriages or for Indian marriages. Your piece for RNS cited a survey that found an estimated 93% of marriages in India are arranged by either paid matchmakers or parents, which is just an astronomical amount of marriages in India. So what does that kind of matchmaking look like today? And what are families looking for when they're going to match people?
Yeah, it's been going on for so long and it's still just as prevalent, I would say. It's very close to my own experiences with my own family. My dad's brother, my mom's brother, both of them were arranged marriages. And the way that it would kind of work is that your family or even your neighbors would kind of be like on the hunt. They'll know like, oh, we have a son or daughter who's of marriageable age. And they would know like, oh, well, we have a friend of a friend who's in the same community as us. And by that, I mean religious and cultural community in India. And, you know, they are both in a similar field of work, or they both are wanting to live in Delhi. So why don't we just introduce them and like see how things work? And so that I would say is kind of what arranged marriages look like. It's definitely between the families. And, you know, to go more in depth, I'd say usually the girl's family is the one who hosts the guy's family. That's just how it worked in my knowledge. And, you know, the girl would kind of make chai, make some snacks, kind of like a test out of, you know, how good of a wife could she be? Overall, though, it's really about, will the families, you know, match together? And if you're already knowing who these families are and you're already knowing, oh, they come from a good family, then it's like, okay, well, love and attraction can come later. My own parents had a love marriage, though. They either call it an arranged marriage or a love marriage there. And they met and fell in love.
In India?
They met in med school, actually.
Was their love marriage frowned upon? I mean, obviously, statistically, they would have been in the minority to choose that path toward marriage. Was there backlash?
There wasn't backlash. I think it would be kind of a little bit of the opposite, where it's like, oh, that's so great. Like, that's so amazing that you were able to do that. Like, that's just kind of the way it is to get an arranged marriage. And it's like, oh, all of a sudden you were able to find someone. Thankfully, they're both, their families got along.
Yeah. So there wasn't backlash, maybe because it met the criteria that they might have been looking for.
See, that's the thing. Like, they met in medical school and like they were already living in the same city. And so it worked out well.
You've kind of said arranged marriage and matchmaking. Are they different or are they kind of a piece, like similar? There was one person you talked to in your reporting where she was like, this is not the same thing. This is not an arranged marriage. This is matchmaking. What's the difference?
I think the reason she was saying that is because arranged marriages do get kind of like the misconception that these are forced marriages. These are forced upon, you know, the kids that don't want to actually get married. They don't love each other, that kind of thing, which of course still does exist. You know, maybe they're not ready for marriage and their parents are pushing it. But for the most part, going to a matchmaker is like, you're going with your family to see this person or this agency or this website.
When families choose to go to a matchmaker or an agency, is that a kind of status option? Is that considered for a more elite portion of Indian society than if you were to work through families for an arranged marriage?
I think yes and no. I think that there are definitely like, it's not just for rich people. It's not just for, you know, elite status people, matchmaking, I mean. But I do think that now these matchmaking agencies are popping up that are like really focused on your net worth. And in particular, I think we're seeing this more in the diaspora. It gets even more niche because it's like you want someone who is both Indian and American, and you want someone who's raised with both Western values and Indian values. And I mean, one of the agencies I talked to, like, they're offering stylists and they're offering wellness practitioners and astrologists and these services just to make sure like you are an eligible candidate and you are at like the highest level that you can be for marriage. I mean, obviously that costs a lot of money. You know, I think the show, actually the Indian matchmaking show, really showed that these are really wealthy people who are looking for other really wealthy people. I think the difference is when, you know, the money comes in. One thing I did want to mention about the biodatas, they also oftentimes have horoscopes. Yeah, your sun sign. Because in Hinduism, a lot of the times, traditionally, when you are matching people, when you are doing an arranged match, you still want to ensure that they're of a compatible horoscope, which is very, very interesting. And that's why, you know, the service I was talking about has an astrologer.
The gist of your piece is that these services and this draw toward matchmaking is actually is on the rise or people are interested in it. And you mentioned like, because they're kind of sick of Western dating and the apps, which I totally get, resonate with that. So people are kind of being drawn back into this more traditional practice. But you also mentioned that they're kind of trying to meld like matchmaking and some Western dating practices. So what does that look like for some of these agencies?
They're kind of repackaging matchmaking for people because, I mean, a lot of us second generation Indian kids, we have seen, you know, members of our extended family getting arranged matches, or they have seen a matchmaker, or they have gone to a matrimonial website. And that's not always what we want to follow. It's like, you know, we were born and raised here and we want to find love, you know, the way that we see in movies. And like, you know, we don't want to go back to what we think is traditional. But then in the same way, there's this weird thing where it's like, okay, but we were raised to be very family oriented, and we were raised to, like, you know, have a marriage be between two families a lot of the times. And so it's like, I do want to make my parents happy. And so it's like, okay, these agencies have caught on to like, okay, how do we mix this? Like, how do we get these kids who are looking for, you know, real, true love, but mix it with something that has worked within our families, you know, for years. Specifically, I'll talk about the matchmaking convention.
Yeah, I wanted to hear more about that.
That's actually the one that kept popping up on my Instagram feed. And I was like, a matchmaking convention. And basically, you know, thousands of people are applying to be on this roster to go to this convention, which is at, you know, a very fancy hotel. The dress code is very nice. You're in your like nice Indian getups. And the idea is that it's a very exclusive thing where, you know, your education level matters, the way you present matters, things like that. And these are people who, I mean, if you would have like said like, oh, you're going to find your husband or wife at a matchmaking convention like 20 years ago, it'd be like, oh, like, no, like, that's not really what I want to do. But they've really like now with their social media presence and with, again, back to the Netflix show, back to the idea that like, you know what, maybe it is cool to be within our own culture because of all of these things. And because of, you know, the exclusivity of like, oh, like, I hope that I'm deemed like a really successful individual.
What happens there? Like, what do people do?
What the founder, Anit Patel, he was telling me, basically, all the attendees are given an app and given like the list of all the people who are attending and like their like mini bio data kind of. So they'll be able to reach out to whoever they're interested in. But besides that, it's a series of social events. There's like a cocktail hour. There's dance classes. There's yoga classes. There's after party reception. But most importantly, there's like several sessions of speed dating. That's another thing, is that speed dating is also on the rise because these people are, you just want to know that the other person is serious about, you know, finding love. Right.
Do they pair people for speed dating based on bio data, or is it just anybody that goes to the convention?
It seemed like anyone.
Okay.
It's matchmaking in the way that the entire pool is like eligible, if that makes sense.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, it sounds like a speed dating marathon, which doesn't immediately sound like something I would pay a lot of money to do. But also, I see the appeal of at least meeting people in person, and especially if this organization or this company has already filtered out kind of the best of the best, so to speak.
And you're just spending really the whole weekend with other single people. So it would feel like the odds might be in your favor.
Yes.
And that's what he was saying about like meeting in person versus dating apps. Dating apps, you know, as we all kind of know, are difficult nowadays. Like, yeah, they might look good like on, you know, the website or whatever, but you never really know until you keep going out on these dates. And that's why you get burnout from all of these dates, because you're just keep trying new people. And what you're doing is just like, you know, presenting yourself over and over again. So that's their kind of solution. And he did say that a lot of people like get upset if they didn't find anyone at this matchmaking convention.
They start
kind of getting, you know, like leaving bad reviews in a sense of like, oh, well, the music was too loud. Like, I didn't like it at all. Like, you know, so.
Before we get to your India trip, which we want to get to, are there any other like specifically religious elements to these matchmaking practices or traditions, or is it just mostly like broadly Indian as a practice, whether you're Hindu or Muslim?
So yes, it is broadly for Indian, whatever religion you are, Hindu, Jain, Buddhist, Sikh, Muslim. Mm-hmm. Matchmaking is in our culture as Indian culture. But, you know, in speaking to these matchmakers, I've found that most people do actually want to stay within their religious community. Right. And, you know, even for the conventions, for everything, you're given a list of like, what are your preferences when it comes to religion? And mm-hmm. even when it comes to, you know, language you speak, because there's so many mm-hmm. in India, and the ideal match for a lot of people's families would be someone who is both in the same exact religion and not just Hindu, mm-hmm. the specific religion you're in or sect or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that was very interesting. I just kept asking people, I was like, do you think people are getting more traditional now? Like, you know, even though we're mm-hmm. born and raised here, like, are we still sticking to our own communities? Are we still sticking to our roots? And it's like, yeah, actually, yeah, we are. Mm. It made me think a little bit. I'm like, how much modernity and tradition, you know, are we really blending by being these children of immigrants?
Yeah.
We want to say that we're so, you know, liberal, so open-minded. We are born and raised in this country. But at the end of the day, our families do really, you know, really mm-hmm. matter.
And there's also just a pragmatic, which is maybe a Western individualistic way of getting about it, but there is something pragmatic about sharing the same religious tradition and speaking mm-hmm. the same language. When you think about melding your life with somebody, those are two pretty big pillars that, you know, mm-hmm. there's data to suggest that compatibility on those points actually mm-hmm. matters and works for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So tell us about the India trip. You recently went. I got to hear and read several stories from that trip, but you went to a wedding. So tell yes. us a little bit about the wedding. What is a Hindu wedding like, other than being 3 days? And you had a lot of great henna art on your hands.
I did. Thank you. The thing that stuck out most to me is in my head, I started making a list of stuff I don't want to do, like the stuff that I've never, because for one, no one is really paying attention. Hindu ceremonies are very long, honestly. Mm. And like, there's so many different little things that need to be done. Mm-hmm. You know, some people don't even come for the actual ceremony because they're like bored.
How long are we talking here?
We're talking like, I'd say at least like 2 hours, but longer.
Oh, wow.
So that's where it's like, oh, people can just kind of show up whenever they want. The couple is like really in deep into these rituals that are being done by a priest, but no one else is involved. You know, there's no like vows. Hmm. There's nothing like that. It's really just about the religious aspect. And so, yeah, that I was like, I want people to pay attention. And that's, again, I've been influenced by, you know, other cultures, marriages mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. weddings. So
what else is specific?
The groom will come in on the very typical thing is a horse or an elephant. He'll ride in. The bride is kind of somewhere else, but this is like his moment to come in, which is different from like, you know, the mm-hmm. white dress bride walking down the aisle. It's like the man coming to meet the girl.
Mm-hmm.
On this trip, your family was asking a lot of questions about your marital status. What was that like for you? Like, how did you receive those questions?
It was crazy. I always heard the stereotype that like, oh, as soon as you turn 25, like people are gonna, you know, jump on you about marriage. The last time I was in India, it was 2019. And I think I was not even 20 years old. And, you know, people just let me live my life. No one said anything about like marriage or even boyfriends or anything like that. And then all mm-hmm. of a sudden it come this time. And if I got a compliment from my relatives, like, oh, like, wow, you look so nice in that like traditional dress, it would be followed by like, okay, time to get you married. Or like, wow, like this photo that I just saw of you is beautiful. Like, time to put it on a matrimonial website. Mm-hmm. You know, something also very funny that I wanted to say is that someone's uncle saw me walking with my uncle in the neighborhood and like told my uncle that he has a nephew in the United States who like works at Tesla. Mm. And like, he was like, yeah, I know. He was like, oh, like we should introduce it. So like it happened to me.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I didn't expect it to be that often that people were commenting like, oh, it's time. Mm. It's time. It's time. And I was like, yeah, like, sure. Uh-huh.
Are you going to meet up with this friend of your uncle's nephew?
I'm certainly not.
Oh. I thought you were going to say we're engaged. Just kidding.
Would have been good.
I'm just curious. Do you have a sense of, assuming you would like to date or pursue romance, do you have a sense of how you want to go about that moving forward?
That's a great question. I'll bring this to something that I talked about with these matchmakers is that a lot of the times my friends will look at me and they'll be like, oh, you know, it's great that in your culture, matchmaking is a thing because like if all else fails, like you'll have that to turn back on. You know, we all want to love marriage is what they would say. We all want to like meet someone organically. We all want to get off the dating apps. It's not that fun. And like, I'm thankful, like, yeah, I can marry this Tesla guy. Like,
yeah,
I don't want to, like, it's more important to me personality than it is, you know, oh, on paper, we would match perfectly. It's what a lot of people want, but.
So you've got a safety net.
I've got a safety net.
Are you going to be like, okay, if I hit 35.
That's exactly, no, that's exactly my thought.
Wait, really? 35? I mean, is that the number in your mind? Like, okay, at this age.
I don't know what it is, but in my mind, I'm like, okay, 30 years old. Like, I think it's just because we were raised to be like, okay, 24, 25.
Right.
And then hearing all these people like being like, oh, now you're of age. It's crazy. Like, I guess I am. Like, that's kind of what I, that's what, like, I guess I am. So, yeah, I would say 35. If it really doesn't work out for me in any other way, then I will. I will turn to it.
Thank you for such an interesting conversation. And thanks for letting us pry a little bit into your
I love it.
Personal life.
It was great to be on. Thank you.
Saved by the City is a Religion News Service production. The producer is Jay Woodward and the consulting editor is Paul O'Donnell. We get production assistance from Julia Wintem.
Chaz Rousseau put together our look and Martin Fowler wrote our theme music.
We are Roxy Stone.
And Caitlin Beatty.
Thanks for listening. All right.
Harry.
Oh, right.
Okay, that's first, actually.
Of course.
Harry. Intellectually curious.
Great.